This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Jay, normally during a week, we'll sit down and talk about the politics, and this is an odd week because we have the legislature expanding beer and wine sales, hooray, and also Sid Miller misspelled Psalm, so big week, but we actually have something different in mind this week, right?
That's right, Brandon. We have a very special guest joining us today, none other than John Lovett of Pod Save America fame, progressive podcaster extraordinaire, former Obama speechwriter, Hillary Clinton speechwriter, producer, celebrated kind of Hollywood raconteur. And of course, you are one of the funniest guys on radio and in the podcasting world. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me. What an intro. Celebrated raconteur. I don't mind it.
We wanted to start just to get a kind of broad scope of your sense of where the field is. And we've got, like Jay says, kind of a small village of people running for president on the Democratic side. What's your take on sort of some of the top level people, pros and cons, and kind of what's your sense of the state of the race, which I think is probably materialized to the point where we're at capacity? We'll see.
No, the door is closed. Joe Biden is the last one allowed in. He shut the door behind him. We are at a Baker's 20, and that's it. That's the last. We cannot. The boat is full. No one else is getting on.
There are not enough vans in Iowa to transport all these folks, right?
Right. The infrastructure of Iowa and New Hampshire cannot sustain this. There is not enough butter, and there is not enough milkshake. There was an interesting poll that came out, and it said, you know, so for the past couple of months, you know, there's been poll after poll has shown Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden in the lead. Let's say Joe Biden is somewhere around, you know, 25%, maybe more, maybe less. Poll came out today and it said that he was at 17%. Here's why the poll was interesting. Most polls read people a list of names and people pick who they want, right? And you do a poll like that, about a quarter of the people turn around and say, I want Joe Biden. This poll, they just said to people, who do you like? Who are you going to vote for? Who are you leaning towards? And they didn't give them a list of names. They just said, name somebody. And 17% said Joe Biden. And what I appreciate about that is there's a roughly 8% of Democratic voters who want Joe Biden to be president, but also can forget that he exists, which is, I think, a strange place for a voter to be. But I think it tells you, so also that what came out of this poll, in which people had to come up with who they wanted, is that a plurality of people, their candidate is, I don't know yet. And I think that's really where people are at. We have a very, very big field, and nerds like me, nerds like you, I don't want to presume, are paying attention very closely.
No, that's a good presumption. We are right up there.
Smart people who are not enamored of politics, who are living good lives of substance, unlike what we do, are realizing that it's a mistake to pay attention so closely this early, and they're kind of holding back, and they're going to decide later in the process.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. Brandon and I were just talking about the fact that it's incredibly wide open. You've got this massive field. One of the things that sort of caught my eye was that back in 2008 and 2012, and even in 16, a lot of the sort of the intellectual energy on the Democratic side were coming from sort of centrist-oriented candidates. Mm-hmm. And what I find fascinating in this cycle is what it seems like is that a lot of the policy ideas and policy proponents all are coming from the left. Elizabeth Warren obviously sort of got more policy than everyone combined and enough for maybe two or three campaigns. But it's interesting to me that the center seems to be kind of the left now. And I'm curious what your take is on that.
You know, I think that's true. I think it's a confluence of a lot of different factors. I think one important piece of this is the way Obamacare was processed by our politics. You can be someone who thought it was a great idea. You could be someone who thought it was a bad idea. But ultimately, it was a compromise proposal that drew from conservative approaches, that tried to push as far left as the Democratic Party at the time could bear, but it ended up with a market-based approach that provided subsidies for some people, expanded Medicaid for others, provided new rules of the road to protect people who had private insurance, and Republicans vilified it as socialism and have been dead set against it from day one, continuing to efforts right now to have it be repealed. Republicans, when they didn't control the White House, repealed it dozens of times. They came within an inch of repealing it legislatively during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And so there's a lesson in that, I think, which is no matter how much you seem to try to moderate, to reach out to Republicans right now, the way our politics are, you don't get much credit for it. There's not a lot of benefit to sanding down the corners of your ideas to try to appease an opposition party that's not interested in giving moderate proposals a fair shake. That, and I think also, look, I think Trump winning exposed something for people. I think there's been a real shift in the way we talk about politics. I think for a very long time, there was a conversation about how people feel left behind. You know, oh, they feel left behind by today's economy. But I think the combination of mistrust in institutions, of dissatisfaction in the economy, of the ability of someone like Donald Trump to demagogue so successfully around issues like trade and immigration has shown that there were weaknesses that Democrats had that they weren't fully cognizant of. That Barack Obama, in many ways, I think, was thought to represent a new, was supposed to be a harbinger of a new Democratic coalition that was going to be indefatigable. But it turns out, actually, it was the opposite, that by dint of his incredible talents as a politician, he hid some of the political liabilities we didn't fully understand. And I think you see candidates like Bernie Sanders and candidates like Elizabeth Warren and others saying, we want to meet this moment. We want to meet the scale of economic challenges that have left people feeling so vulnerable and exposed that someone, the door was open to someone like Donald Trump.
You know, John, one of the things that we teach in class, we're both political science professors, is that we look at sort of affective polarization, which is basically people see the world through the sort of sense that either you're with us or you're against us. Do issues matter anymore? And will issues matter in 2020? Will any of this actually connect to people? Or is it simply just an us versus them as a result of, say, the presidency of Donald Trump or the presidency of Barack Obama, where it sort of crystallized this partisanship in such a way that people are ignoring what maybe is in their best interests and not really sifting through the tough details, and instead are rather kind of voting kind of against a person because they perceive they don't like them for various reasons?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I would think about it is less that people ever vote against their own interests, but people will tell you what their interests are. They'll tell you what their interests are when they vote. And there are people out there who decided that they were going to vote based on these grievances over some of the more meat and potatoes economic issues that maybe in a Democratic proposal would have benefited them more than a Republican proposal. In terms of what happens once they're elected, I think one of the reasons I think we were vulnerable to someone like Trump, it's not because people don't care about policy. It's that for a very long time, people didn't feel as though they were being heard, that they didn't, that policies weren't speaking to the problems in their lives, whether it's around trade, whether it's around economic inequality, or a host of other issues. I think that people have not felt as though Washington was hearing them. Washington was responding to the actual needs in their life. And if in a situation like that, where you don't believe either party is really answering your problems, it leaves the door open to a demagogue. It leaves the door open to a candidate who can excite people's racial animus and misogyny and other kind of vices, cultural vices, that allowed someone like Trump to be elevated.
John, you know, a couple of things. You know, we're here in Texas and we've got two home state candidates. And the way they have both been, I think, sort of came on the scene, how they were dealt with by the media. O'Rourke clearly had some initial momentum, got a ton of press. He sort of come back to earth.
Then he got Buttigieged.
Yes. Well, and that goes exactly to the second point. We both are admirers of Julian Castro as he was a successful mayor here in Texas, but he has just gone nowhere. And the national media in particular doesn't seem to care much about the guy. What's your take as to why, to Brandon's point, nobody cares about Julian Castro, but a whole lot of folks seem to like the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana, 37-year-old Pete Buttigieg?
Look, you know, the vagaries and vicissitudes of cable news, I don't understand them myself. And I'm actually excited because Julian Castro is going to be a guest at one of our shows in this on the Love It or Leave It Texas tour that we're about to do. So I'm excited to talk to him, and I'll ask him about this. But you know, it is a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is when a candidate doesn't break through, the questions that are asked about them and the conversations about them are why aren't they breaking through?
Right.
There's a problem in that everything is punditry, right? You know, there is an interesting problem, which is when you know we're talking about impeachment, right? And when people at town halls ask about impeachment, they don't say, "Hey, I'm afraid impeachment's a bad idea. I want you to focus on healthcare." What they think is, "Look, obviously it should be impeached, but I'm afraid it's going to look like overreach and it's going to hurt our ability to win." Right.
Right.
That a conversation about politics that treats everybody like a pundit succeeds in turning everyone into pundits. And so I think one of the problems is people have now trained themselves to not ask, "Who do I like?" but ask, "Who do other people like? How's this person doing? Where are their polls at?" Now, that's the climate. What's interesting is you have candidates like Beto O'Rourke who have had moments of extreme national attention and then kind of gone quiet. We've had candidates like Julian Castro who have struggled to get national attention. We've had candidates like Elizabeth Warren who have managed to kind of get that microphone through policy. Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, right? These are Pete Buttigieg is now in the middle of a moment where he's getting a ton of national attention. What actually happens in the polls? Not really that much, right? So I think it's really important. I don't think that these candidates should totally disregard when they're getting covered or not. But this is a very long process in which people like Julian Castro, people like Mayor Pete, people like Beto, they are on the ground and they are making their case. And I think the reason Mayor Pete has had this moment is in part because he said something interesting and surprising that seemed to speak to this moment in a way people didn't expect. He offered a specific rationale for his own candidacy, a kind of generational argument. He speaks in a way that is different than other presidential candidates in terms of a kind of soft-spoken and introspective tone that I think appeals to a certain base, part of the Democratic base, and it happens to be a part of the Democratic base that's on Twitter, that is in places where there are reporters, that kind of has made it possible for him to have a really big moment. But all of that will fade away if these candidates are not successfully making a case on the ground in places like Iowa, in New Hampshire, in the early contest states, where a lot of this comes down to retail and a lot of this builds over a very long period of time. You know, one thing I think was, we were talking about this today on Positive America, who do you think was leading in the polls in 2004 in the Democratic primaries right now in this stage of the race?
Oh, geez. 2004?
2004.
I'm going to say Edwards. Just a guess.
No, I thought Gephardt was ahead, wasn't he, at this point? I know Howard Dean was like nowhere, and he just sort of started surging, but I thought
those were both my guesses. It was Joe Lieberman.
That's right.
Joe Lieberman, who goes on to sabotage the Medicare buy-in and endorse John McCain. Things change very, very quickly. You know, like, we may look back on this moment and say, wow, what a boring primary. Joe Biden walked away with the thing and it was the most predictable event in the world. Or we may not even yet be talking about the person who's the Democratic nominee. We just have absolutely no idea.
Except in 2004, we nominated a guy who ended up losing. So we should always remember that.
Well, look, if Democrats couldn't learn lessons from when they lose, we'd never have any lessons to learn.
That's right.
Losing is when we do some of our best work.
Right. I would actually ask you about the Democratic Party in general. And there's a sort of these various theories in political science that sort of suggest that the party has a tremendous say in who gets the nomination, right? You've got this sort of metrics that we think about as being important, fundraising and, you know, endorsements and things like that. But then we're reading things more recently like, you know, Twitter is sort of populated by like a very small percentage of actual individuals who are promoting this kind of narrative. And we talk a little bit about that kind of progressive change in the party, and that's altering kind of who runs for president. So I guess the general question is, like, what do you see the changes are in terms of how the Democratic Party has nominated individuals since, you know, 2008, say, and what is the sort of long-term legacy of any kind of change that we might have seen?
That's a very good question. It's one I would like political scientists such as yourselves to answer before I answer it. However, I think the one thing that I think is true is the role of the party has been exaggerated for some time, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in 2008, Hillary Clinton was the presumptive front runner, presumptive nominee. I mean, she was ahead by huge, huge amounts in polls. There were few that were going to successfully challenge her. And yet Barack Obama is able to stage this insurgent campaign and win. In 2016, Bernie Sanders, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton had even more institutional support, is able to mount an insurgent candidacy and, based purely on his own fundraising and reach to individuals and media, is able to mount a campaign. Now, I think they to this day carry some resentment over the way the DNC behaved during that. But it's, you know, I think you can look at that and say that Hillary Clinton did not win that nomination because because it was given to her. And, you know, even now, you know, we're having this debate about what superdelegates will do or won't do. Superdelegates mm-hmm. didn't decide in 2008. They didn't decide in 2016. I think it's really important that we have a DNC that's fair and forthright and open and transparent and even-handed in how they treat the candidates. And I think that's what they're really carefully trying to do with the debates right now. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, I think we exaggerate the role that the DNC has played.
I mean, historically, midterms have not been particularly good predictors of what happens in general elections. Obviously, 2010 to 2012 being the most obvious, even 14 to 16. So what's your take? I mean, 2018 was a banner cycle for Democrats nationally. And here in Texas, with not just Beto O'Rourke, but just demographically, Brandon and I have talked a lot about the state trending. And it looks to us like it's really a purple 50-50 state. I'm curious, kind of from a national perspective, how y'all view Texas. Do we see 2020 as a continuation of 18? Or do you return back to form? And do we get a second term of Donald Trump to talk about?
Oh, I hope not. Here's what I'd say. First of all, Texas, you're like Lucy with the football for Democrats. You know, you just put that football out and you know, Beto gets all ready and he runs up and he takes a big kick and there's no football. I would say, like, to me, the biggest lesson from 2018, it was true in Texas, it was true in Georgia, it was true across the country, is I think that there's been all this coverage and conversation about the motivated Democrats and the lesson of 2016. And we've seen incredible new energy and new organizations and new enthusiasm, new participation. We saw the biggest turnout of young people in 2018. And all of that is incredibly exciting, incredibly important, and is actually one of the reasons to be optimistic about what will happen in 2020 if you're somebody who believes that Donald Trump is a uniquely terrible person in a role for which he is uniquely unsuited. But I think one of the parts of 2018 that is under-discussed and undercovered is the fact that Republicans turned out too. Right. Beto O'Rourke in Texas, mm-hmm. he gets the votes he's supposed to get to win. Right. They have their models and he gets his votes. But they're surprised by the number of Republicans that also turn out. The same thing happened across the country. The Republican turnout machine is actually incredibly sophisticated. It's not. And it's in part, I think, based around the information ecosystem, the right wing machine that's the Fox News and other outlets that kind of motivates people, that spreads information through Facebook and social media, that kind of keeps their base excited and enraged and aggrieved and ready to participate and feeling as though they're under attack. And I think that's a big part of their success, and it's deeply troubling. But it's also a sophisticated Republican turnout machine that they've been building as well, with a lot of heavily financed operations coming from some of the wealthy backers of the Republican Party that has put them in a really strong position. And all of that is just a note of caution that all this coverage of Democratic enthusiasm, there's a Republican enthusiasm too, that everybody recognizes that what's happening, in part because of Donald Trump, that this is a momentous time in our political system in which the stakes of our elections are so high. And that's something that Democrats understand, but it's something Republicans understand too. Now, what does that mean for 2020? Great question.
One of the things we saw today is that the Texas has been traditionally kind of an ATM for, you know, politicians, especially Republican politicians. Trump took about $6 million of his $100 million haul out of Texas. So there are lots of
in like one night, right?
Yeah.
Did he like just show up?
There are still huge numbers of Republicans who are going to turn out for the threat of a Democrat winning. And so you've got it essentially twofold. You've got it at the presidential level, and then you've also got it at the Senate level. We're going to have a pretty competitive Senate race here. MJ Hager, who is definitely in the race, maybe Joaquin Castro, he's holding his breath and tap dancing a little bit around this, but he's also threatening to get in. So what do you make of kind of where Texas stands politically in terms of kind of what the rest of the country will do?
You know, I think we've seen Texas is changing, right? It's changing at the national level. I think you see places like Texas changing a little bit slower than places like Ohio are going in the other direction. Mm-hmm. It's almost like this race, this like demographic race for Democrats to have more success in places like Texas before places like Ohio slip away.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know. I think we won't know the answer to how that's playing out until the election results come in. You know, we just saw the most incredible Senate race in Texas, right? It captivated the country. And someone people thought wouldn't get close managed to get within 3 points of Ted Cruz. Does that mean Texas is changing? Does that mean Beto O'Rourke was uniquely talented and going up against someone widely considered to be a, let's say, an underperforming Republican. Because
or as Jay says, he's the Zodiac killer. So
right, I mean,
you don't make friends that way.
I'm sticking by that one, Brandon. I'm sticking.
I just, you know, it's like Ted Cruz, man. You know, he performs worse than a generic Republican, right? We got to assume that. So I don't know. I think all you can really do is organize. And I think the really positive result of Better Work running in Texas is we saw a ton of success at the local level. He helped flip a lot of local races. Yeah. And showed how you can organize in parts of Texas where Democrats hadn't necessarily been in such force for a long time. So I think in that sense, it's exciting. But the answer to all this is the same as it always is, which is who knows? We just have to organize and turn people out and do everything we can.
John, I want to shift gears a little bit. I know you've got you're coming to town. You're coming to Houston.
We are.
Yeah, we're excited that. And I know you've been really this leader. You and your partners in crime at Crooked Media have been kind of the leaders of kind of progressive podcasts. And what's made you guys really interesting to us, and we try candidly to do a little of that ourselves and try to inject humor into this. You were famously a joke writer for President Obama.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of curious, how does political humor work, and how does it work in particularly in terms of trying to get information out? That rise of, we see it on late night TV a lot now, obviously with Comedy Central and Trevor Noah and et cetera. But I'm just curious how you see humor fitting into this in terms of our broader political discussion and kind of this new media genre as a whole, and what you guys have been able to do in terms of podcasts.
Yeah, so there's a story that I like to tell about this, which I think captures how humor can break through in a moment where everything is so polarized and divided up and siloed, so that people are getting their information from myriad sources in ways that it's kind of hard to break through and get people's attention. President Obama gave a State of the Union. It was a long speech, as they all are, where he discussed every issue under the sun, the major economic threats, the major foreign policy threats, the successes of his administration. At one point during that speech, he was talking about reorganizing part of the government and doing some reforms to make government work better. And he told a story and he said, you know, there's one part of the government that looks after salmon when they're in freshwater. There's another part that looks after salmon when they're in saltwater. And you wouldn't believe how complicated it gets once they're smoked. Now, that amount of laughter is the appropriate amount, not much.
Right.
Just like a tiny, like, huh. You know, in the room, I got a kind of, I would say, a mild, it was a really quintessential uncle joke. Here's the thing that happened the next day. I think NPR called a bunch of people and said, what do you remember from President Obama's State of the Union? And they had two word clouds. One was the words that were in the speech. The other were the words people remember. Now, the words in the speech are what you'd expect. Economy, jobs, taxes, Iraq, you know, the words that tend to be in a presidential State of the Union equally distributed. The word cloud that said, what did people remember? It had salmon in giant letters in the center of the box. People walked away from that speech thinking the president said a few things about the economy before giving a speech about salmon. Humor sticks with people. It connects with people. I think one of the reasons a joke bombing hurts is the same reason that a joke feels so good when it lands. It shows that you're connected to somebody, that, hey, you and I, we share the same context. We share the same subtext. We share the same sense of the absurd, the same history. In fact, we share so much that you can surprise me about a topic in a way I don't expect, because we all know the same exact information. We're coming into it from the same perspective. That's what I think a joke can do. It can delight you with a sense of shared purpose. I mean, that's a pedantic and overwrought way of describing it, but I think that's part of it. And so that's the role it can play. That's why when President Obama would go to the correspondence dinners and mock politicians, mock the press, it would be so effective, because it's a way of, look, when even the most sort of hard-edged, hard-nosed, we're not partisan, we're on nobody's side reporters, when they're laughing with you, they're laughing with you. They're with you. They're with you on the joke. And that's true for any audience, which is why when a politician tells a joke that bombs, it hurts so much, because it's like, you don't know me at all. Get out of here. You skipped the hell.
It seems
out of
to
here.
Me like speech writing is one of the hardest things, because you have to channel the voice of somebody else, especially somebody like a president who tends to have kind of big personalities. But even more difficult would be writing a joke for that person. So we just had the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and obviously, famously, Trump didn't come. What for you is the hardest part of the maybe tips in terms of how to write a joke for a politician who maybe isn't as funny as you are?
Well, they never are. No, I'm just kidding. So one thing is, I think you have to really remember that if it doesn't sound like that person, it's not going to ring as true. I mean, one of the reasons I think Barack Obama was so effective at those correspondence dinners is because he sincerely shared our sense of the absurd about the way the media was covering politics, about the state of Washington, and that sort of freed him up. You know, in terms of what his approach would be, what I would argue the approach for a politician to be to humor is, you can only be as harsh with a joke directed at someone else as you would be against yourself. And if you're not willing to be self-deprecating, that anything you do to make a joke about someone else, I think, will come across as mean, especially when you're the president, because, you know, a lot of jokes are never about punching down, right? When you're punching down, you're just bullying.
Yeah.
And he's the president. So when you're the president, everybody's down. So it's a challenge, right? Which is why I think part of the reason he was so successful is he would always start by joking about himself, right? You know, it's great to, you know, I've been president for so many years. I'm not the strapping young Muslim socialist I used to be. Like, these are... That joke, that was a good one.
That was a good one.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there's been this sort of larger conversation about kind of how effectively to go against Trump. Trump is famously, as you said, sort of the polar opposite of that. He is the consummate bully. So is the...
And he never laughs,
And he
right?
never laughs, right? He has no sense of humor.
He never laughs.
So the interesting thing to me is, do you think the approach ought to be to kind of get aggressive with someone like President Trump, or is humor kind of the way to do it? And if so, who's kind of best equipped? Who's the affable, funny candidate in this bunch?
Now, I feel like there's two questions in there. There's one is like, should you go after him for these kinds of, for the ways in which he bullies people, for his rhetoric? I think the answer is yes. I don't think it's appropriate when you have someone out there who is being so vicious, who is... encouraging his audience to laugh at asylum seekers, which I think would be the definition of punching down, when he's somebody who's going on stage and making outlandish claims about doctors that I think are pretty dangerous and reckless. When someone says that there are good people on both sides, I think you have a kind of moral obligation to speak out against it. But the question is, how do you do that in a way that is the most effective? And, you know, Donald Trump has been president now for a couple years. He's been a presidential candidate and a president for what feels like 1,000 years, I think it started 1,000 years ago. I believe that's when he first came over the wall and attacked Hartholm. But people know who he is. They know what he sounds like. They don't particularly like him, right? You know, that feels to me baked in. And so if you're going to make a case about Donald Trump, if it's about his outlandish rhetoric, it's about how silly and awful a person he is, I think we should assume that people understand that. So to me, it's about taking that information and making it part of a richer and deeper case about the failures of his administration and who his policies benefit and who they hurt, right? George Conway is like, oh, we're going to call him Deranged Donald now. Terrific. Have we not learned anything? Like, you think we didn't win in 2016 because we didn't have the right nickname? Give me a break. Give me a break. No, we didn't. We need to make a case against this person. And if you want to make his rhetoric part of that, I think you should. If you want to make his vilifying of immigrants part of that, I think you should. But it has to be part of a larger story about why he does that. And I think he's doing that because he has to talk about things, about anything other than what he's actually doing to help people, because he had an opportunity over the past 4 years to decide what was important. And what was important was cutting taxes for corporations, cutting taxes for billionaires, gutting regulations for polluters and banks and other big corporations, while demagoguing around immigration and trying to divide people, because he doesn't care at all about anyone but himself. He has spent the last years of being president running from investigators, hiding the truth, protecting himself, making money, and doing the bidding of corporations, because it's not about you, it's about him. And to me, that gets at the heart of the matter. And ultimately, a presidential candidate campaign is about big ideas. It is about big questions facing the country. And nicknames feel very small to me.
John Lovett, thank you so much for joining us. It has been such a pleasure. Good luck on your Texas tour and with everything else, and we hope to see you and talk to you again in the future.
Can I do one joke?
Yes,
please do.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Love It or Leave It is coming to the Cullen Hall on Thursday, May 2nd. We'll have Arian Foster, Emily Heller, and a lot of other really great guests.
That sounds great. Very good.
Sorry, that was awful.
Well, I've seen better. I'm a huge 1600 Pennsylvania fan, so I love that.
Are you? Are you the one?
I actually was. I remember watching it on Hulu. I really enjoyed it.
People thought that show was too silly, and now it's just a documentary.
See, I think it speaks to something. I think it really has that resonance, and it was a play on that made it feel better. So I think... kudos are in order. But thank you for joining us.
Thanks,
this has
John.
Been really wonderful.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us at the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall. Special thanks to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And big thanks to our audio engineer, Todd. Todd Save America. Paul Slater.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.